ATD.org. Free agent pitcher David Phelps on the Brewers finalized a one-year contract. The 33-year-old right-hander was 2-1 with one save and a 3.41 ERA in 41 games for Toronto and the Cubs last season. The WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. The light precipitation is scheduled to end over the next couple of hours, giving us a cloudy day, a high of 35, some 6 degrees warmer than normal for this time of year. A slight chance of more snow and freezing drizzle this evening, a low of 29. Then for the weekend, mostly cloudy tomorrow, a little warmer, a high of 36. Then for Sunday, a real treat for those of us who like warmer weather this time of year. Mostly sunny skies with a high around 49. By the way, the record high for the state is 58. That mark set in 1989. Expanded forecast, looking at some precipitation for the early part of the upcoming work week. Rain and snow in the forecast for Monday and Tuesday. Right now, with some light snow, freezing drizzle continuing to fall, we have a temperature reading of 32. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Both of our interviews today come from the morning show archives. Well, this is the third time on the morning show that I have the pleasure of speaking with best-selling writer Mary Roach, who has to her credit a couple of the most interesting books that I have ever read in my long history with the morning show. One of them called Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. The other called Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. And those may be tough acts to follow in terms of writing books in untrod territory, but she has managed to do something equally interesting, if not more so, in this book called Bunk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science. And in this book, as much as anything, Mary Roach is helping us explore the world of those scientists who want better to understand our sexual lives as human beings, and the way in which a little farther back in history, science, or should we call it quasi-science, was making some attempts to enter this world in some sort of analytical fashion. And right up to the present day, and to fascinating studies and experiments which go on all the time, and typically a bit out of the public spotlight, to help us understand this really fundamental aspect of human life. And as with the previous two books, this particular work is both interesting and enlightening and also very, very entertaining. And no surprise given a writer of Mary Roach's great abilities. Again, this book is called Bunk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science, published by W.W. Norton and Company. And Mary Roach, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
So tell us if any single thing drew you to this particular topic for book number three.
In fact, something did. I was leafing through an old issue of Film Quarterly, which is not something I regularly read. I don't even remember why I had a copy, but I came across a reference to these films that Masters and Johnson, the great sex researcher of the 60s and 70s, had made using actually a tiny camera and a light source that they had embedded into a clear phallus that they were using to actually measure the responses of the sexual responses of a woman. I thought, wow, sex research, that's got to be the next book, because it was just this, it had never occurred to me before, well, if you're going to study sexual physiology, you're going to have to figure out a way to get at it, because first of all, it tends to happen in the bedroom, it's very personal, and in the case of women, a lot of it's going on out of view, inside. So I thought that with the challenges of that kind of research were fascinating. So that was what got me rolling.
Well, and of course, what's especially interesting is the way you've explored how generations ago, I mean hundreds of years ago, this question was starting to occur to people. I mean, mm-hmm. the question of what exactly is going on and why, and how in the world we can come to a better understanding of that. I mean, that's what some people were, mm-hmm. the kind of question some were posing, and others, of course, were making great pronouncements without any hard and fast information. And I mean, that ends up being this wonderfully interesting tangle through history that you sort of untie for us a bit.
Sure. I mean, going all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci was, in fact, one of the first of these people you're referring to who really tried to figure out, well, what is going on? And Leonardo, for most of his anatomy studies, used cadavers to, you know, to see where the parts were and what they did. But of course, with sex, that would be obviously a little problematic. You know, and I suppose it would be technically, maybe not even technically possible. But anyway, he had a couple of drawings that you know, they looked like they were cadaver drawings, but in fact they weren't. It was two people having sex, and he was just imagining them from what little information he had. And there was actually some quite large errors. For example, he had this idea that there was this physical interlocking that happened between the man and the woman, kind of like a Pac-Man sort of opening up and clamping down, and that the cervix was actually, you know, doing that, which is not true. And it was believed for centuries that when a couple couldn't get pregnant, they had a bad interlock. So that was, it took all the way up to the 1890s to dispel that myth. And that was done by a fascinating guy, Robert Latou Dickinson, who was a gynecologist, and he was just an extraordinary guy. That he was a family man, and he was a churchgoer, but he was also determined to improve the sex lives of Americans, because he believed that it was destroying a lot of marriages. And so, anyway, he got very, very interested in sex research and the anatomy of sex, and he had a technique, sort of a precursor to Masters and Johnson, in that it was he would use a test tube, not in the way that most scientists use test tubes, and he actually he inserted that into a woman and then shined a light just to see, you know, what is the path that it follows, and does it actually hit the cervix head on? And it doesn't, it just slides right by it. So he was able to debunk the whole coital interlocking myth, and that was a very courageous thing for him to do, given that this was, you know, the turn of the last century.
Hmm. Well, and of course, that's an abiding theme in many of these historical accounts you give us, is that this was something that, in a sense, a serious scientist, or just a serious person, even if they weren't particularly a scientist, in a sense, to explore this field was to do so, in a sense, at one's own professional peril. I mean, mm-hmm. you were really risking a lot.
Sure, yeah. It was, you know, if you look at John Watson, who's the father of behaviorism, he was a psychologist at Johns Hopkins, and he is sort of famous for bringing human beings into a laboratory setting. And he's the one, you know, he would condition a fear of white rats and a little boy. I mean, he's just known for bringing things into the lab that weren't up to that point done in a laboratory, and that actually included sex. He felt like that sex is something that should be studied in a laboratory, and of course it was very difficult to get somebody to be a volunteer or a subject back then. And what a lot of them would do is they would do the research on themselves, which obviously makes them look a little funny. And he, John Watson, got actually was having an affair with a student, and unfortunately the story is that he used himself and her, and then someone found out, and that was kind of a he ended up losing his post for various reasons, but you know, it was definitely not this was the 1920s, and no one was quite ready for people being hooked up to instruments and measured while they have sex. It just was not you know, sex is biology and physiology, but it's also personal and intimate, and something that you don't take out of the bedroom for a lot of people. So,
right. You know. The first line of your acknowledgments, you say, sex research is a little like sex in that most people who engage in it are more comfortable without an audience.
Exactly.
And indeed, it had to be kind of a tricky matter for you, at least in some cases, to go knocking on the doors of some of these current day researchers, and you didn't speak just to scientists. You spoke to also to people who market certain products and devices and so on. But I mean, in many cases, these are people that are not accustomed to this sort of scrutiny about their work. And you even mentioned that in some cases, researchers have to conduct certain sort of mainline research which can help fund some of these other undertakings, which they probably couldn't possibly get funded from official sources.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's in some cases, they'll do fertility studies that just to get a source of income. Other times, what they'll do is use a more generic word in the title of a study. For example, they'll say physiological instead of sexual, because there are databases you can search by keyword, and some very conservative family values types of groups have been doing searches and then finding these people's work and then spotlighting them for criticism or ridicule, or trying to get them to trying to get the government not to fund them, etc. So even today, it's very difficult for sex researchers, because it's just people assume that if you're doing sex research, that you're a bit of a pervert, and you know, if sex is it's a basic physiological anatomical process, and to not study it would that would be like saying to somebody, oh, why are you studying the esophageal sphincter? We all know how to eat, So, but people tend to say that, why are you studying sex? We all know how to have sex. We know everything there is to know.
It's interesting.
In fact, we don't.
It's interesting, too, when you talk about William Masters back in 1954 embarking on one of his first serious investigations of sexual physiology. You said, given the political climate, it was exceedingly brave of Masters, then a gynecologist at Washington University in St. Louis, to undertake his project. This was to be a largely, with nearly 700 participants, non-clandestine observational study of human sexual arousal and orgasm. To try to get funding and permission for such a venture in 1954 must have been, well, like trying to do it in 2007. In other words, the point is, as tough as it was then, it's not much easier now, if it is, in fact, any easier now to engage in this sort of study openly.
Yes, actually, I would say that for a study like the famous Masters and Johnson 700 people sexual response and orgasm study, I don't think you could do that today. Actually, I think that the climate is more conservative. I mean, this was the 60s when the book came out. The 60s was, even though it's going back several decades, a lot more open, certainly sexually, than things are now. I don't think you could have done a study like that today.
You mentioned that in light of the difficulty of studying human beings engaged in sexual activity, which obviously would be the most direct, in a sense, simplest way to study this, that scientists have attempted to study sexual activity in other ways, going so far as to even study creatures like porcupines. And as you tell us in the book, you don't have to look very far or hard or long before you realize that the activity of porcupines in this department is not particularly relevant nor helpful to a human being's understanding their own sexual nature.
No, but it sure is entertaining because the male porcupine apparently does this thing where he rears up on his hind legs, and then at a certain point he hops around with one paw over his genitals, and it's a very entertaining description of what male porcupines do when they're courting females, but not a whole lot of overlap with human beings.
Right.
Interestingly, porcupines, if you ever wondered how porcupines manage to have sex given all the quills, the female flips her tail up and over the quills to provide a little protection for the male. I thought that was interesting. But anyway, terribly relevant to men and women.
Right. Although you say then, however, for many years, this was in fact the way scientists, leery of social censure and career demerits, studied sex.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there would be these interesting and of course, fairly isolated exceptions in which there would be doctors and scientists who, for whatever reason, or maybe for a mix of reasons, would find themselves drawn to this topic and would engage in study of it in fairly direct fashion. You tell in this very same story, right after talking about porcupines, about a doctor by the name of Robert Latou Dickinson, mm-hmm. who right around the turn of the last century, as a gynecologist, would take down very detailed sexual histories of some of his patients. And apparently you were able to access some of those records. And it's really kind of astonishing to imagine a scenario in 1890 mm-hmm. where these kind of questions were being asked and being forthrightly answered.
It was kind of astounding. He had as a gynecologist, he had a wide range of clientele, and he did some charity work at the tenements in Brooklyn Heights where he worked. And it was through talking with some of his tenement patients who were more willing to talk frankly than some of the upper-class ladies. It was talking with them that he realized that women would actually, if you asked them, they would tell you about their sex lives, what was going right, what was going wrong, and even how they best preferred to be stimulated and what worked for them and what didn't. And so he had this tremendous body of work that was really rivaled something like the Height Report almost 100 years earlier.
You also mentioned that this Dr. Dickinson was one of the primary inspirations for the much more famous Alfred Kinsey, who, of course, embarked on sexual research that was really unprecedented for its scope and breadth.
Yeah, it was in speaking to Dickinson that Kinsey first became interested in sex. Kinsey was a biologist studying gall wasp speciation, traveling around the country and gathering gall. I guess the gall is something that the wasps live in. I'm not entirely familiar with the gall wasp, but anyway, he was applying his boundless research energies to gall wasps, and then met Dickinson, and over the course of several conversations decided that this would be perhaps a little more relevant and important, and that's what got him rolling.
It's interesting. One of the studies you tell us about is something which essentially occurred in the attic of Dr. Kinsey's home. I assume the attic of his home,
yes.
In which couples of various types and stripes were observed in this activity and observed very closely. And he undertook this because he believed, probably correctly, that to undertake this kind of study more in the public eye or openly mm-hmm. would have been unthinkable and unacceptable at that point in time. And you tell us that we look now at that going on and can be forgiven for wondering about the motivation and if there wasn't something a bit perverse going on here. But you say the closer you read the kind of observations that Kinsey and her staff were making, really the less perverse it becomes, because they were, as they were observing this activity, they were making note of things that have nothing to do with arousal or sexual interest whatsoever. I mean, it gets to be actually, in a sense, fascinating because so much of it's so tedious.
Yeah, they were right. He would be documenting things like the earlobes swell during arousal. You know, he had this tremendous observer's eye, and he you know, all the thing with research like that is no matter who you are and how dedicated a scientist you are, to the outsider, if you say, oh yeah, well, we bring these people in and they have sex in the lab and we watch, it just sounds perverted. There's no way to get around that. And in any other area of science, if you describe what you do, very often it entails, you know, bringing something into a lab and observing, but you don't sound like a pervert. I mean, somebody who studies genetics and, you know, looks at gene material under a microscope, nobody's going to say that's perverse. But because it's sex, no matter what you do, people, there's a little bit of raised eyebrows and what's really going on. So there's almost no way to get around it.
And, right. Except, as you said, when you read his accounts and you realize he's observing and describing what's happening with the salivary glands, that starts to look a lot less sinister and more like a real scientist seriously interested in understanding this bodily function.
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah.
We're talking with Mary Roach about her newest book called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. Among the most entertaining pages in this book are when you help us understand how the world of machinery has intersected with this world, both in the sense of scientists seeking to understand sexual activity more clearly, and then, of course, the way in which some of these machines and devices are patented and marketed even to the general public. Tell our listeners, for instance, about the $20 you put down in order to attend an event called Sex Machines.
Well, yeah, here's how that came about. I was determined to see this extraordinary device that Masters and Johnson had built that I was speaking about earlier in our conversation with the... it was essentially a penis camera, if you will. It was they called it the artificial coition machine, and they were trying to observe what was happening with the human female reproductive organs during arousal and orgasm. So which is an extraordinary thing to have built and figured out. So, and I very much wanted to see it. Unfortunately, from what I hear, it's been dismantled. The Masters and Johnson don't have an archive like Kinsey does. There's not really a repository of all their files and equipment and things like that. So somebody coincidentally around that time who works at the local newspaper gave me a press release about a book launch of actually an art photographer who had taken pictures of inventors who had invented homemade sex machines, which are, you know, in concept very similar. Mechanically, a similar concept to the Masters and Johnson machine, of course, no camera or light source. So I ended up paying my $20 and going to this event, which included some inventors and their machines who were there and giving demonstrations, not live demonstrations, but, turning on the machines. And so it was interesting to see perhaps a modern version of what that machine might have been like.
You also met somebody named Marty Tucker, chairman and founder of the world's second largest sex toy manufacturer. And among the many things that's interesting in that portion of the book where you talk about meeting him and some of the things that he has developed and has marketed is the way he would talk about these things. You said Marty talks about his goods frankly and technically as though they were car parts or kitchen appliances. He says it's just product. Everybody who works here is immune to it. It's not sexual anymore. It's like a keychain or a wallet. It's nothing. And of course, for those of us not so acquainted with such things, it's a little hard to imagine that, but it seems to be the case that for them it happens to be the thing they make and sell.
Oh, yeah, for someone like myself walking in, it's a huge warehouse in Chatsworth, California, and you walk in and you'll see a guy walking by in a hairnet and a smock carrying, just a huge armload of these, silicone phalluses piled up high, or there'll be a couple of women chatting and laughing while they're hand staining some of the testicles of one of the products, and I said to Marty, you know, these quite fairly young Latino women that we were watching, and I said, what do you think their parents think of this? And he said, well, I asked one of them, and I said to her, well, you know, what do your parents say? And they said, oh, we just tell them we work in plastics.
And leave it at that.
Yeah.
In a sense, it runs kind of interestingly parallel to what you tell us about rhesus monkeys, and for that matter, most creatures of the world other than human beings. You say in that sort of comfortable, offhanded approach to it, to any creature other than you and I and 6 billion other privacy-needing Homo sapiens, sex is like peeling a mango or scratching your ear. It's just something you do sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that is an interesting distinction that we draw between, for instance, the rhesus monkey and human beings, that for us,
sure,
this is something different.
Sure, yeah. I spent an afternoon at the Yerkes Primate Center in Emory, outside of Emory University, in the outskirts of Atlanta, and there was a researcher who studies sexual behavior and hormones in females and female humans, but primates are a good species to look at because they have the same hormones. And so we spent this afternoon, you know, in the observing deck above the enclosure, sort of watching these monkeys' courtship and sex. And, you know, in a way, it just felt like, well, this is wrong. We shouldn't be watching them. But on the other hand, they are so, you know, it's so out in the open. It's no different from them, you know, like picking up a piece of monkey chow and sniffing it. And it's just one more behavior. It's over very, very quickly. And they don't have any of the sort of trappings of, you know, romantic foreplay or it's just something they do from time to time.
I want to close with an interesting thing you mentioned towards the end of the book, again talking about Masters and Johnson. They are an important presence in the pages of this book. And you are at this point talking about a study which they did, which was very intriguing to you, which they titled Persons Studied in Pairs, which didn't begin to really convey just how interesting this study was. But what I think is really interesting is when you say, as always, and like most sex researchers, Masters and Johnson were stingy with the irrelevant details. And you know from what they wrote, where they set the thermostat and a few other things, but you longed to know much more. And it's so intriguing. I think in this book and in probably your other books as well, in a sense, what you have been searching for are the so-called irrelevant details,
which
so often bring us the most interesting stuff of all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to know, you know, in one of their books, they said, well, the couples were allowed to play music. And of course, I wanted to know, well, which music, which albums were they listening to? You know, you just want to be able to set the scene in your head because you're so curious. You know, what was that like, particularly with some of their studies where you had couples, and in some cases, they actually assigned people to each other who had never met even, and that was, I mean, it was an extraordinary. I thought, well, how did were there couples that said, no, I'm not going with him. You got to give me someone else. You know, I just wanted to, you know, to talk to these people, to see the laboratory. You know, I mean, you're just starved for that kind of detail that you just want to know. Well, what must that have been like? And for the researchers, of course, they feel that, you know what, that's not the point of what we were doing. It doesn't matter, you know, the point, here's the important stuff, and it's in our books, and why isn't that enough? But for someone like me, of course, it's never enough.
So at the end of this book, did you feel a great deal of frustration that there was a lot to uncover that was hard to uncover, or do you feel like mostly you got the most burning questions answered?
Well, I was a little frustrated by the inability to get in touch with some of the folks who had done some of the old Masters and Johnson studies. But really, there's so much, you know, I had to travel overseas a bit to find, like I was in Cairo, actually, for oddly enough. So I was willing to go fairly far afield to find, laboratories and researchers who were perfectly fine with my coming along and observing. So I felt that I did, on the one hand, I couldn't get what I ultimately dreamed of getting. I certainly felt like I found enough interesting and fascinating things to fill a book. So.
Well, that's for sure. The book is called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, published by W.W. Norton. And Mary Roach, it's been fun once again to talk with you. Best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. This was so much fun. Thanks.
The time is 8:40. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out with a fun interview with author Susan Davis, talking about her book, the title of which just about says it all, Searching for Mary Poppins, Women Write About the Relationship Between Mothers and Nannies. Here Susan Davis explains a little more about that title.
The title of the book, Searching for Mary Poppins, actually comes from the fact that nearly every one of the writers in the book mentions Mary Poppins. It's a way into the topic, and they all say, all I knew from nannies, all I knew about nannies, I learned from Mary Poppins. I never had one. I never really saw one. My friends didn't have one. Most of the women in the book grew up not in a class where nannies were all around. And a lot of these women, nanny is a catchword for babysitter in your home. So some of these women, their nanny's only there 10 hours a week or 12 hours a week. Some of these women share the nanny. But for us, the criteria was another woman, and usually it's a woman. There is an essay in the book about a manny,
right.
A young man. But it's really the criteria was another woman coming into your home, your intimate space, to take care of your children.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that for many of these women, Mary Poppins was maybe the image that popped in their mind. And
sure.
And many of them didn't have nannies as they themselves were growing up. But
right.
Someone, maybe more than one writer, mentions the fact that even if they did, a generation ago, the image of who a nanny was likely
right.
to be was so different from
right.
who that kind of woman is now.
Now, exactly. There is one writer in the book, Daphne Merkin. She contributes regularly to the New York Times Sunday Magazine and to the New Yorker. She was raised by a nanny, and it was actually a pretty terrible experience. And for her, she has very few memories of her mother and her nanny being in the same place at the same time. So that she, even though she was raised with a nanny in her life, she too has very few models for how it's done, how you be a nanny's boss, because when she was with her mother, the nanny wasn't there. When she was with the nanny, her mother wasn't there, and she didn't see them interact very often. And she didn't care for how she was raised by the nanny. She didn't think she was raised lovingly or well. And it was very frightening for her to go ahead and decide to hire somebody to help out with her daughter when she was a single mother and needed to work. And in those days, when Daphne was raised by a nanny, nannies were older, single, white women imported from Europe. And in the book, you'll see that nannies are from everywhere. Some of them are young white women, college students covered in tattoos. Some of them are legal and illegal immigrants from from South America and Central America and from all over Asia. Some of them are girls trying to move into the city from rural America. Some of them are young male college graduates on their way to grad school with a very bright future, you know, wanting to do a certain kind of work with children before they go. So the variety of nannies in the book is really, it was important to us that we get that variety of experience. Many of the nannies are mothers. Too.
Yeah, it's a dizzying array of different sorts of people, and almost none of them fit that stereotypical image of a nanny that is referred to in your title. It's interesting too. One of the cases, one of your writers talks mm-hmm. about how they just had it in their mind that they wanted a French nanny,
right?
And that ends up being actually a rather unhappy experience. One of
yeah.
the more unhappy experiences described in this book.
Yeah, that's the very well-known novelist and biographer Roxana Robinson. She talks about being a young mother in the 70s, so a long time ago, and she worked at an auction house, an art auction house in New York City, and it was a fairly patrician life she was living. And she very much wanted to complete the picture. It's an and it's a romantic picture she had invented for herself about what a patrician life would be like for a young woman in New York City working in a genteel business. And she was determined that her daughter have a French nanny. And she found this woman and essentially hired her because she was French. And only later does she confess that when she called this woman's references, they weren't that great, and she sort of put that out of her mind and talked herself into this woman because she fulfilled some fantasy that Roxanne had. And she wasn't a very good nanny. Part of what's interesting of that in that story, too, is the turmoil inside Roxanne when she knew she had to fire this woman and how hard it was for her as a woman to fire another woman, how she had no experience dismissing people, and the toll it took on Roxanna. And we very specifically placed that essay in the book next to an essay by a woman named Alice Elliott Dark, who many years after Roxanna, and let's say many years after a kind of mainstreaming of feminism and of ideas about women being empowered and in positions of authority, Alice had a very similar situation where she had a nanny who was not good, and she had proof that the nanny wasn't good, and she had to fire her. She knew she had to fire her. It was so hard. It was so hard because Alice was a woman and a mother, and she didn't want to fire this other woman who was also a mother. The responsibility that women feel in these positions of authority and being somebody's boss, those problems haven't been solved by the progress of the culture. They're still there. That part of being a working mother doesn't ever seem to go away.
We're speaking with Susan Davis, one of the editors of a book called Searching for Mary Poppins. Women write about the intense relationship between mothers and nannies. In a couple of instances in the book, this relationship, which is already going to be intense, I mean, in almost every instance, just by its very nature. In a couple of instances, this relationship is made far more intense because of something rather extraordinary occurring in that particular home. I'm thinking in particular of an essay by a woman who hires a nanny who happens to be a man at a moment in time when this woman's husband, that is the mother's husband, is dying of some kind of rather terrible disease. And the really incredible relationship that springs up in every direction from this stranger in their home. It's really amazing.
That's I'm so glad that you said that, because that essay was, we considered that essay long and hard. It's called In His Memory. It's by Andrea Nakayama. And she's a writer in Portland, Oregon. And it was really such a difficult story for her to tell, because there were so many stories going on at once. In that, when her son was very young, her husband got very, very sick with brain cancer. Her young husband, he died at 33. And she needed help in her home to take care of her son so that she could, one, take care of her husband, and two, keep working, because somebody had to keep working to keep them going financially. And she had never hired anybody to do anything in her life. She's a writer. She's always made a living as a book designer and someone who's in charge of book production. She works with contractors and vendors, but she's never hired personnel. So imagine doing that in a context so fraught with emotion, because having anybody come into your home to do anything is intimate, but having somebody come into your home where your beloved husband is dying is, you know, even more sort of intimate. She hires a young man. She wanted to hire a young man because she was worried that her young son was losing his father figure and his male role model, and she knew that it was the start of a long life for her replacing that and making sure that there were male role models in her young son's life. And she liked the idea of, besides her, the other person who held her son and bathed him and loved him and hugged him, be a man. So she hired this young, recent college graduate who's going to go to graduate school in a few months. He was already set to go, I believe. But he shared Andrea and her husband's values, and it turned out he shared all kinds of things with Andrea's husband, Isamu, taste in music and taste in books and taste in philosophy. And a lot of time when their son was napping or their son was with Andrea, the nanny, whose name was Matthew, would spend time with Isamu, and he really became Isamu's last friend. And it's a beautiful story. Of course, it's terribly heart-wrenching because Isamu dies, and Matthew also goes off. And she closes that essay with this wonderful image of how Isamu and Matthew stay alive in her son's heart and how it's possible they're confused in her son's heart because he was such a little boy.
Who was who and who was what to him? And
right. She's not sure that when he's talking about his dad, he might be actually remembering Matthew, and when he's talking about Matthew, he might be remembering his dad. And she comes to a place of peace about that it doesn't matter, really, because those were his sort of last fathers in those early stages of his life. And since then, he has an uncle, and he has role models in his life. But, yeah, that's a particularly heart-wrenching circumstance. There are some essays that have very extreme circumstances. Elizabeth Graver has a very harrowing tale of hiring a nanny who only later, after they had become very attached to the nanny, confesses that she has her own daughter the exact same age as Elizabeth's daughter, which means she's still very young, which was sort of upsetting for Elizabeth. They then let that nanny bring her daughter to work with her, and they really become a kind of family. But then that nanny, they even incorporate that nanny's mother. But then that nanny also gets involved with a man that Elizabeth and her family would not necessarily approve of, but they're not really her family, so they can't approve or disapprove of him. And he winds up causing them some tremendous anxiety. He becomes a kind of threat, a real physical threat to their family. So it gets very harrowing, when you take somebody into your home and into your life, you don't always know who else is coming with them.
Well, and another recurring theme in this book is that sort of that age-old line about you just when you think you know someone.
I mean,
time and time again, these women who hire nannies and babysitters will often be surprised, and often in fairly unpleasant ways, especially,
right,
however, in a way which in some ways seems almost naive. That is, this assumption is made that this woman that has come into your home to care for your child has a very special, strong attachment, and that they would only leave that relationship for the most serious of reasons, when in fact, in many cases, that connection will be cut quite suddenly, sometimes for no apparent reason at all. And it is sometimes the ending of these relationships that is particularly difficult.
Yeah, there's a terrific essay in the book called Dumped by Pamela Kruger, where she talks about figuring out the hard way that I need to go back to my home country is the nanny version of let's just be friends. It's how a nanny breaks up with you. I think one of the most interesting things about the mom-nanny relationship, the mom-babysitter relationship, is that each side thinks the other one has all the power, and it's not for the same reasons. Moms think that the nannies have all the power because the nannies can quit on a moment's notice, the nannies can make demands about hours and pay that the moms may not be able to meet, and the nannies have in their arms all day the mom's children, their most precious children. And you want to believe that even if this woman has a squabble or a bone to pick with you, she will still always be good to your child. And mostly this is all going unsupervised. So your child is with your nanny precisely because you aren't there. And there are some other moments in the book, also in Pam Kruger's essay, where people pass on information to her, I saw your nanny. And it's, you know, those are very spine-tingling words to a mom, because moms need their nannies to make their lives run and to get their jobs done. And nannies think that moms have all the power because moms can change the rules and they can change their demands and they can change their circumstances. And in the end, if they say the child can't eat any chocolate and they find out you've given the child chocolate, they can fire you. You know what I mean?
Fire you for less than that. I mean, they can they can essentially fire you for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Right. Right. And nannies are, they're terribly unprotected. There's no union. You know, there's no collective bargaining agreement. There's no minimum wage. Mm. So
it's an enormous amount of trust which is involved in this. And, of course, you establish that trust, and then to have it shaken or even shattered is pretty bewildering.
Exactly.
I have to ask you, does it bother you at all that, in effect, this book is entirely one-sided? That is, the subtitle is Women Write About the Intense Relationship Between Mothers and Nannies, but not a single essay is by a nanny. It's all from the point of view of the mothers. I mean, it's not that I regret that it's done that way. I mean, I loved this book and found it very interesting. But in effect, it is a one-sided telling of this relationship.
Yeah, that's very, very true, and I'm glad you asked that. It does not bother me at all, only because Gina and I intended from the start only to make this book. It's not a work of investigative journalism or journalism of any kind, so that we weren't attempting to give two sides of anything. We were attempting to fully and richly represent one side, the side that we knew, the side that we had personal experience with, and the side that we had professional access to, writers. And we turned to writers because they're good at telling stories, and the best writers articulate for the rest of us our common experiences. We wanted very much to counter the image of the nanny employing mother that came across in that best-selling novel called The Nanny Diaries,
which is
about to be released actually as a movie, and was written by two young women who had been nannies on Park Avenue. Most of the mothers in that book don't work, you know, so they're having a nanny is a different equation for them, more of a luxury, in a sense. Yeah, than the women in our book. We were working against that image. There are some terrific sociological studies of women in the global economy, women doing what's called domestic work in the global economy. Barbara Ehrenreich has done some terrific work on this. There are some good books that do a lot, that collect oral histories and interviews with nannies. We were not attempting to do that at all. We did wonder about doing that. And the logistics of having a nanny speak honestly about her current employer, that's naive to expect that.
Right.
Also, we wanted writers. We wanted people who could tell their own stories. We didn't want to have to tell the stories for them. We didn't want that responsibility.
Very good.
And that's what would have happened if we had tried to pair up a bunch of moms and their nannies. Somebody would have to tell the nanny's stories for them in rich language, and we weren't prepared to do that either. So we got the book we set out to make. We met our own expectations, absolutely.
Susan Davis talking about her fascinating book called Searching for Mary Poppins. Monday on the morning show, William Bernstein and his fascinating book, The Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. On Tuesday, a nationally known speaker on the topic of racism, Tim Wise, who is speaking at Carthage College Tuesday evening, joining us Tuesday morning. The title of his talk at Carthage Tuesday night is Great White Hoax, Challenging Racism and Denial in the Age of Trump. On Wednesday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, will join us. On Thursday, Cal Fussman and a book called After Jackie, Pride, Prejudice, and Baseball's Forgotten Heroes. It examines the experience of those black baseball players who followed in the wake of Jackie Robinson. Life was not very easy for them. they faced all kinds of challenges, and their largely forgotten stories are told in this fascinating book. This is an interview we are airing during February Black History Month. And a week from today, we will preview for you the production by the Lakeside Players of Little Shop of Horrors.